Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
New York Times bestselling author Stefan Talty is an Irish-American journalist and author who writes detective fiction and nonfiction books on crime and American history. Two of his books have been made into movies, Only the Brave and the Oscar-winning Captain Phillips, starring Tom Hanks. Stefan Talty has contributed articles for the New York Times Magazine, GQ, and Playboy. Today I'm going to ask him about his true story of the American School of Spies, the archaeologist who fought the Nazis and saved the treasures of ancient Greece. These American archaeologists went undercover as spies during World War II to fight the Nazis and protect the world's most precious relics. Stefan Talty, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, I couldn't help wondering how you got interested in this spy story.
You know, it goes back to a photograph, which I actually reproduce in the book, and it shows some curators in a black and white photo lowering this enormous Greek statue into a dirt trench. And I don't know how I came across it. It kind of just jumped out at me. And I had to know more about the story behind it. So I looked into it. And of course, the story was that the Nazis were approaching in 1941. And the Greeks decided to hide all their great relics and antiquities in various places. They put them down wells. They put them in caves. They put them in private homes. But most of the really true masterpieces they put under the floor of the National Archaeological Museum in Athens. And so this photo led to a whole unraveling of a story of archaeologists and classicists from different countries, mostly American, but also Greek curators and even one German archaeologist who really, during the war, endeavored to save, you know, these great masterpieces for future generations. And the Americans, of course, and the Greeks were also at the same time fighting the Nazis. So to me, it was just this great kind of fish out of water story. Like, how did these classicists who were really knowledgeable only about wars 2000 years ago, how did they enter the arena and really perform so well? They really made a difference in Greece during the war. And also, how did they save these relics?
Well, in your prologue, you introduce some of these people that play roles, important roles in your story. And after I read the whole book, I went back and reread the prologue and said, oh, yeah, he told us about these characters and about the Greek desk, and he mentions these things in the prologue. But then in chapter one, you start off telling us about this guy named Rodney Young. And you say, just after dawn on October 28, 1940, and what was his background, this guy named Rodney Young?
You know, he's a fascinating, complex character. He was a rich kid. He was the heir to an American beer fortune who got fascinated by Greek antiquities. And while all his classmates from his college went off to work on Wall Street or Madison Avenue, he decided to actually go to Greece and dig in the dirt. He worked in a place called the Agora, which is the ancient marketplace in the center of Athens. And he just began digging up artifacts with the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, which is kind of the mecca for antiquity studies in Greece. And he did that for several years.
I thought maybe his mother and her tastes also played a role in his interest, because how did she decorate? What kind of home did he grow up in?
You know, he grew up in New Jersey in a couple of mansions. And yes, his mother was a huge fan of Greek style and Greek culture. And so there were stained glass windows. There were marble statues that were copies of ones that you would find in ancient Greece. And also his class, by which I mean the elite in America at that time, they looked to Greece as this sort of arbiter of what was beautiful and what was true, because they were dealing with an America that was sprouting these factories, that was pitching smoke up into the air, and they really felt they wanted a kind of elegant, beautiful design for their lives, and that was Greece. So he had these two influences, but then he sort of took them on as his own profession, went to Greece, fell in love with the people, fell in love with the relics. And when war came, he really decided to, you know, to do his part.
Well, you know, I think I can thank this group for the career that a friend of mine had. When I was taking second year Latin in high school, he was taking third year Latin. He went on to teach classics. He taught at UCLA. And then he went to Athens and he dug up tablets. So he was a classicist who kind of became an archaeologist. And I'll bet he wished he was born sooner because he was a baby when all this was taking place in Greece. But there are so many times that I stop and it really made me think. And sometimes it made me mad. And sometimes it made me admire these people. I'm sure it was an emotional ride for you too, writing this book.
It was. A few years before, my family and I went to Athens just on vacation. And before I was even thinking of this book or saw that photograph, you know, we toured the museums, but what really impressed me about Greece as opposed to maybe France or something like that is, you know, in France, you have to go to the Louvre to see the masterpieces. In Greece, you know, you could be on your way to the bakery and turn a corner and there's this ancient statue right in front of you or an ancient amphitheater. It's really sort of part of the lives of ordinary Greeks. And when I did my research, I found that during this time, the 1940s, many ordinary Greeks believed that the statues were actually inhabited by spirits. They had this idea that they called them Arabs, this kind of soul of the statue. And they saw them as living things and really representations of their ancestors. So I was fascinated by this really close relationship between normal Greek men and women and these 2,000-year-old statues that they considered to be almost like the physical representation of their ancestors.
My guest is Stefan Talti, and he has written a book, The American School of Spies, The Archaeologists Who Fought the Nazis and Saved the Treasures of Ancient Greece. Now that I've mentioned Nazis, what history did the Nazis learn? What did the Nazis teach about Greek history?
You know, they had this kind of fascinating theory that the ancient Greeks were actually kind of proto-Germans, that people had come down from the north, from the area that became Germany, settled in Greece, and created this wonderful civilization, the seat of democracy, Sparta and Athens. And this was something that was really essential to the Nazi view of themselves. Hitler was obsessed with this idea. He wanted this glorious past that he could be part of. I think a lot of dictators, you know, want to claim a legitimacy that goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And Hitler actually sent archaeologists out into Germany to look for a glorious civilization that he could call, you know, his ancestors. And they came back with like wooden beer mugs or these really modest fortifications. And he was, you know, he was so frustrated that I think not only his narcissism, but this idea that he was the latest in a long history of great men and great leaders could not accept that his ancestors had only produced beer mugs. So he looked to Greece and kind of stole their ancient history away and claimed it as his own. And this is what people learned in grammar school and high school. They believed that Greece was their ancient homeland. And if they invaded, it was not, you know, an occupation. It was just a return to their roots. So this was really widespread throughout Germany. Many of the officers and soldiers who came and occupied Greece really believed it. They believed that this was their homeland, which there was no connection archaeologically. They could never find a, you know, an Aryan ancient Greek missing link because it didn't exist, of course. The Germans had nothing to do with ancient Greeks.
And I guess if they'd had a way of testing genetically, they would have claimed, Aryans were that built ancient Greece were our genetic ancestors.
Of course, yeah.
So how far back did that go, that Germans pined for, in your expression, pined for Greece?
Well, you know, it was part of the elite education of a lot of countries at the time. Like, of course, if you went to Oxford or Cambridge, you learned ancient Greece, Greek or Latin. This was part of the sort of inheritance of any sort of educated Western person. It's just that the Germans felt it necessary to claim ownership in a way that the English or French or the Americans did not. They really wanted to possess this history. So yeah, it was very widespread. And Hitler had this whole sort of team of archaeologists ready to go into Greece once the invasion occurred. And their mission was really to, as I said, find that missing link, find that artifact that looked both German and both Greek. So this was a real part of his war effort. He wanted to, you know, proclaim to the world, we found it. We are the ancient Greeks, and, you know, we have a right to Greece itself.
And you were saying it wasn't just the Germans who felt this way about Greece. Brits and Americans also did. In fact, my first Latin teacher had also taught Greek in high school. And that's hard to imagine now, studying Greek in high school. Well, Rodney need to save these relics. Why did they feel the need? What were they afraid of?
They were afraid of a couple of things. First, they were afraid that Hitler was simply going to steal, you know, the masterpieces and bring them back to Berlin. And he did have a plan to open a museum in Germany with his conquests, with you know, the relics, the statues we know so well. He wanted them eventually brought back so he could display them as, you know, sort of his family portrait. This was like something his ancient ancestors had done. So that was number one. Number two was just the pilferage, like the ordinary soldier looking for a souvenir. You know, when the Germans occupied Greece, they had power over everybody. A private could walk into the best museum in Athens or in Salonika and just take, you know, a 2,000-year-old statuette off the shelf and claim it as its own. And many did. Tens of thousands of relics were carried away out of Greece illegally, some by archaeological missions sent by Hitler, others by just, you know, regular guys who thought, well, this is part of my heritage. I have a right to this. So the Americans and the Greeks knew that. And finally, the third thing was, of course, bombing. They wanted to protect these things from both Allied and German bombs because they were out in the open. They were very vulnerable.
Well, and what they ended up doing, it took them, I think it was 6 months, and they only finished 10 days before the Germans arrived. And, oh, it's just, that's a nail biter that they've got to get, take care of these relics before the Germans get there. So what did they do?
So this was a priority for the Greek government, for their cultural affairs department. Months and months before the German invasion, they started to prepare to hide the artifacts. And the main way they did it was to dig up the floor of the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, which is the main museum in Greece. It has all of the masterpieces that we love so well. And what they did is broke up the concrete, dug trenches in the dirt below, and started lowering these statues into the ground. So they would protect them. They would wrap them up in paper and padding. And then they would just lower them into the ground, cover them with dirt, and put a new layer of concrete on top of them. They used other things too. They put them down into wells. They put them into caves. They asked private people to hide them in their homes. Because the one thing about Greece is there are just so many relics. So what's interesting, I think, is that, you know, we think of saving artifacts during war. We think of the Monuments Men, which was a team of experts that went into France and England and saved, you know, the Renoirs and things like that. But this was very much a grassroots movement. They employed students, laborers, professors, private citizens to protect, you know, the patrimony of Greece. And they did it ahead of time. This was very proactive. So it just shows you the importance that Greeks place on their antiquities, that even as they were facing kind of annihilation on the battlefield, one of their main priorities was saving the relics.
My guest is best-selling author Stefan Talti, whose book is The American School of Spies. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Stefan Talti, author of the true story of archaeologists who saved the treasures of ancient Greece from the Nazis. Now, when I think of World War II and spies, I think of the OSS. And when they were starting this, you tell us that they drew from upper class, Yale, Princeton. And I immediately thought of Julia Child, who had a totally different career, but she was in the OSS.
Yeah, there was a lot of famous people who entered the service. And what's curious, there was always a joke about the OSS that it was male, Yale, and pale. So the head of the OSS, Bill Donovan, just had this belief that if you were from an elite family with the right name, the right background, you'd already sort of been vetted. He didn't need to look that hard into your background. So he used Princeton and Harvard and Yale and sort of the social circles in Manhattan and elsewhere to recruit from. So Rodney Young was very much a part of that scene. You know, he had plenty of money, had a good name. And of course, he was trained in classical antiquities.
Well, also, you tell us how it came about that Rodney earned a medal from the King of Greece. And how did that happen?
Yes, this was before the OSS. So he was in Greece when the Italians attacked. The Italian attack came before the German one. And he was desperate to fight, you know, for the Greeks. He tried to join the Greek army, but they wouldn't allow foreigners. And so what he decided to do was to fund an ambulance, put it together, and then drive it to the battle scene, which was on the border of Albania. And, you know, save wounded soldiers. So just like Hemingway, he did that. He went into the battle zone. He saved hundreds of lives with his ambulance. But then a bomb dropped very close to him and he was hit by shrapnel. So he was badly wounded, one of the first American casualties in Greece at the time. And yeah, the King of Greece recognized that this was an important sort of link to the American people, their first hero, and he awarded him a medal for bravery.
So they get all these relics hidden, and I often looked at your photographs in your book showing this process of how they were hiding these relics, these artifacts. So the Germans come in shortly after they finish this work, and they want to go to the National Archaeological Museum. And what did the Germans find when they went to this museum?
So they walked in and, you know, their heels clicking on the marble, and they looked around and it was bare. It was bare walls. It was, you know, the stone pillars that the statues used to sit on and the little placards that showed what this piece was, but no relics, no statues. Everything had been stripped away. So the staff of the museum was lined up with the director, and the German officer went up to him and said, you know, where are the statues? And the guy said, everyone knows where the statues are. They're under the ground, which was kind of a joke. But
in fact, that was one of the few times your book made me laugh.
The Germans didn't get it at first, but slowly they realized that the antiquities were being hidden from them. And, you know, eventually they came to realize that they must be under the museum. Nobody informed them, but these were very heavy and big statues. They could not have gone far. The interesting thing is that they didn't rush to sort of break open the concrete and pull them out and ship them to Berlin. And I wondered about that for a while until I found that, you know, they believed they were going to be in Greece for millennia. There was no rush. They had won the war. They won the war in Greece, at least. And this was their homeland. So there was no reason to hurry. So they let them stay under the ground for the moment.
Yeah, because I wondered that, too, why they didn't start digging. But that makes sense, what you just said.
Yeah, it was that and the bombing. They knew if they pulled them up and displayed them, you know, the Allied bombers were very active over Greece, so they could, you know, they could lose what they had come to Greece for. So they let most of them stay under, but every day, hundreds and hundreds of other smaller objects were being taken out of Greece, some of which still remain missing. I mean, there are thousands of Greek antiquities in Germany that have never been recovered. But the big ones, the masterpieces, stayed under the ground.
Well, I mentioned it made me laugh when the director joked about the question when the Germans asked, where are the artifacts? But You say the director and the staff could have been shot for not answering that question. That was scary.
Yeah. They could have been lined up. They were protecting, or they were hiding what the Germans considered their own, you know, their own belongings. So, and in fact, several of the curators and around the country, because, you know, Greece has many museums, some of them did get assaulted when they tried to stop German soldiers from taking relics. Some of them starved to death because the Germans starved Greece for 2 years, and the Greeks had no food to feed even their, you know, their archaeological staffs.
That was so disturbing for me, too. I had no idea how many Greeks starved during this time. Oh, gosh, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was surprising to me, too. I mean, Greece ranks, I believe, in the top three per capita of deaths during World War II. I mean, we think of Poland or, you know, we might think of Russia or something.
So many more Greeks died than the French or the Dutch. Then in France and the Netherlands, dying of starvation many more times more.
Absolutely.
Hundreds of thousands died of starvation in Greece.
It's true. Gosh. It was a very harsh occupation. And I do think part of it was that Hitler in Germany saw the Greeks as defeated people. These were people not worthy of their ancestors. Their ancestors had built Sparta, a place that Hitler really admired. But the Greeks had sort of fallen away from that. And even the Greeks themselves felt their ancestors were kind of giants, physically and morally, that these were almost a different race from them. So this occupation and the battle to save their own ancient relics was kind of a test of themselves. Like, could we stand up for our ancestors in the way that they did? So it was an interesting sort of almost unifying message that, you know, we might not be able to resist the German army, but we can resist the pillaging of our own culture.
My guest is Stefan Talti. He's a best-selling author, and his book is The American School of Spies, The Archaeologist Who Fought the Nazis and Saved the Treasures of Ancient Greece. You mentioned, we talked about how many people starved, and they were just lying in the streets, and they wouldn't get buried. This also was absolutely shocking. What did they do if they came across a dead body in the street?
Yeah, every morning there would be new bodies on the streets of Athens. And people would just put handkerchiefs over their face out of respect. And then, yeah, their families would come and bury them, or sometimes the municipality would come and bury them. But sometimes they sat there for days. I mean, not only were there, you know, very few resources to devote to them, but a lot of the people were almost too weak to handle a spade and dig a grave. It was very, it was a very grim scene, like, you know, something out of, not quite the concentration camps, but people were literally starving, you know, on their feet.
Well, since you mentioned starving, and there was, she was a woman, actually, who was so moved by the starvation to try to get something done and finally ended up paying for it herself, never got repaid. And who was that character in your book?
I think that's my favorite character in the book, Dorothy Cock.
Really? Your favorite?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She is a sweetheart, I got to say.
She is. You know, she was a woman in a man's world. She was an agent of the Greek desk. She was sort of the point person who would interview the refugees coming out of Greece and get that basic intel on where the Germans were, where the different units were heading. And she was brilliant at it. She actually outperformed the British, who had been there for decades. So the thing that was to her disadvantage was she was a sensitive person. So she was hearing these horror stories day after day. And she began to really empathize with the Greeks and what they were going through. And yeah, later in the war, she was so disturbed by the starvation she was hearing about, she started to organize food packets to go into the country. And when they weren't enough, or when some agency dropped out, she would just draw on her own bank account. And, you know, she was also a rich woman at the time. And she would pay for the things herself, just basic staples. So to me, a heroic character. She was paid only a secretary's wage for work that she did that many times surpassed the men on the Greek desk. Never really recognized, but I hope the book does make her name a little bit more familiar to Americans.
My guest is Stefan Talti. The book is The American School of Spies. And one question I haven't asked you yet about the Greek desk. And what was the Greek desk?
So that was the intelligence networks centered on Greece. Many of the spies, many of the archaeologists were working around Greece. They couldn't go in country. They would have been recognized. They didn't speak, good enough Greek to sort of blend in with the native population. So they worked out of Turkey and Cyprus and things like that. And what they were doing was they were getting intelligence out and they were getting arms and commandos in. So Rodney Young became not only a spy master, but he was sort of invented his own merchant marine. He had to buy these boats to get into the Greek ports, buy engines, buy fuel. At one point, he joked that somebody was going to request a baby elephant at one point. Like the demands on his supplies was so great. They were getting intelligence out of Greece to tell the Allied bombers where to bomb. And they were getting Greek-American commandos who were volunteers from places like Chicago and New York and LA, 18 and 19-year-old first-generation kids who went in, and those guys were the point of the spear. Acting on Rodney Young's intelligence, they would go and they would, they would shoot up trains or they would blow up train tracks to stop the Germans from advancing and in many ways from going to the continent after D-Day. That was one of the big stories of the Greek desk. Once D-Day hit, Germany was pulling all its troops towards France to stop the invasion. And the Greek desk was tasked with stopping thousands of German troops leaving Greece and heading to the battlefields to fight Americans and Canadians. And they were very successful at it. So it was a kind of a very varied mission. They were sending bombers in to attack, German shipping. They were trying to prevent these German troops from going to France. And they were just generally keeping an eye on Greece and what the Germans were doing there.
Well, there is somebody who helped out with the cause. His nickname was Yanis. He was from Chicago, but his parents were Greek immigrants. And who was this?
He was an ordinary guy who volunteered to be a Greek-American commando, and he was so good at it, he became a captain. So they shipped over, and they got into Greece by boat and by parachute, and he led a unit of about 25 guys roaming the countryside, hitting German targets. And one of the most moving things for me in the book, he's gone now, but I was able to sort of get a memoir that he'd written. And he talked about the partisans who acted as the guides for the Greek Americans. They would take them, through the countryside, avoiding the Germans. And at one point they came on this huge mound in a village in Greece and asked what it was. And it was a mass grave of villagers who had been slain for resisting the Germans. And when he got back to back to Chicago, Gennaris wrote a will saying, I don't want to be buried in America. I want to be buried next to that mass grave because these are my people and these are the people I swore to protect. And I want to sort of, spend eternity with them.
And again, that his name was John Gennaris, and he went by nickname Yanis. Now, since you mentioned his being a commando, I was fascinated by the kind of tools, if you want to call them tools, that the commandos used. In fact, I don't know if you even remember all these tools, so I'm going to ask you if you will read what you wrote in your book, all these different devices that the commandos had at their disposal. Would you read that from your book?
Sure. I've just found the passage, so let me look. Okay. Here we go. The men each carried a comb that contained a file that could be used for sawing through a fuse or, if they were captured, for cutting a rope around their hands. In their packs were handkerchiefs that, when dipped in water, revealed a map of Greece printed in invisible ink. Their wool pants had one fly button that, when the cover was popped, revealed itself to be a compass. And secreted in the heel of one of their boots was an escape kit, gold sovereigns that could be used to buy food or to bribe Greek policemen while the men were hiding. The final item was the most ambitious, a ballpoint pen that didn't write, but instead shot a single 22 caliber, sorry. The final item was the most ambitious, a ballpoint pen that didn't write, but instead shot a single 22 caliber bullet. The kid expressed the OSS's concern that a fair number of commandos would be captured in action.
This is my guest, Stefan Talti. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and he was just reading from his book, The American School of Spies, The Archaeologists Who Fought the Nazis and Saved the Treasures of Ancient Greece. And it sounds hard to believe. And men also had to be in fantastic shape. You'd talk about them marching for hours and followed by mules toting 300 pounds of explosive. Oh, gosh. Weren't you rather surprised at how willing these men were to do the things that they did?
You know, it's interesting. The Greek-American commandos were known for their enthusiasm and their esprit de corps. Growing up Greek in America in the 1930s was not an easy thing. There was a lot of discrimination. Many of the men who volunteered had, you know, seen their parents rejected from housing because they were Greek or denied a job. So a lot of them wanted to prove to America that they were just as tough and just as worthy of citizenship as anybody else. So I'm not really surprised they were going back to defend their homeland against fascists. You know, they all went to Greek school. They went to Greek churches. The Greek community was very tight-knit. So there was an absolute pride in going to represent your nation and fighting Hitler. As far as the physical part, yeah, I was stunned by the training. I'm not sure I could get through it even, you know, when I was 20. But the thing about Greece at the time was the Germans controlled the towns and sort of the lowlands. And the partisans, the Greek rebels, controlled the hills and the mountains. So they had to be ready to go and, you know, climb those slopes. They trained in Colorado to mimic the landscape of Greece. And it really paid off because they could march 20, 30 miles in a night, hit a target and turn around and march back. So they needed to be in that good a shape.
Well, there is another person whose story is interesting. And this was Cornelia. Who was she?
Well, Cornelia was just an ordinary secretary, a German-American working in the embassy in Turkey, where there was an important spy working for the Germans. His name was Agent Cicero, and he was kind of a butler to the ambassador, the British ambassador at the time, and had access to all the man's papers. So the ambassador was getting telegrams about, you know, Stalin's latest thinking or what Churchill wanted to do. And he was copying these down. He was sending them right to Berlin and to Hitler and his lieutenants. And in fact, the information was so good and there was so much of it that Hitler began to doubt that Agent Cicero was not a double agent. They didn't know whether to trust his information. And Cornelia had found out just through her own investigations who the real Agent Cicero was. And had she fallen into German hands, she would have probably been tortured and revealed that Agent Cicero was legitimate. He was not a double agent. So all the information he was passing, especially about D-Day, would have been accepted. And D-Day would have been a different story because Cicero knew where it was happening. He knew it was going to happen in Normandy. He knew the date it was going to happen. So it would have been, you know, a complete slaughter on the beaches of Omaha in Utah. And the fact that the Cornelia was the key to this led the Greek desk to try to rescue her and get her out of Turkey before the Germans captured her.
And so they had to disguise her.
Yes, they dyed her hair. They gave her new clothes and
cut off her hair short.
Yep. Yeah. It really was out of a Hollywood movie. They were shuffling her in and out of cabs. And they knew the Germans were watching the train stations, but they got her onto a train. And just before it was beginning to leave, they jumped onto another train and went in the opposite direction. So it was very much a Hollywood escape. orchestrated by the Greek desk. Yeah.
Something I thought was interesting too, so they could change her looks, her hair, and her color. But when she started walking away, they recognized her gait, the way she walked.
Yeah,
she was recognized her by her walk.
Believe it or not, Cicero was just happened to be on the street when she was being brought to one of her hideaways. And he said, "Oh my God, that's Cornelia. I know that walk from anywhere." So it really was a close run thing. The Germans had shut down a lot of the sort of exit points for travel, and they desperately wanted to capture her because she was the key to Cicero's authenticity. So they barely got her out of Turkey, and eventually she moved back to America and had a different life.
My guest is Stefan Talti, author of The American School of Spies. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Best-selling author Stefan Talti is telling us the true story of archaeologists who went undercover to protect some of the world's most precious relics. Now, the very first character we meet in your book, in the prologue, the first two words are his name, and he plays a role that he felt so guilty about. And who is this person who was just torn by guilt?
His name was Helios Dundalakis, and he was a Greek man who grew up in Crete and volunteered to, you know, to work with the Allies when he was in his early 20s. So the Allies sent him down to Salonika, which is a city in Greece, and asked him to spy on the local units. And he was very successful. He sent many reports about German shipping, and then the Allies would bomb from the air and stop those ships. Or he would say what units were leaving Greece or coming into Greece. So a very effective spy in the field. And towards the end of the war, well, I should say first that he was having an amazing war. He was he had plenty of money, he had girlfriends, he had the admiration of his neighbors for spending freely. None of them knew who he really was. But there was one sort of big mission that he was given. After D-Day, the Germans were pulling a lot of men out of Greece, and it became sort of a transit point, Salonika. So they wanted to stop those men before they got to France to fight the Canadians and the Americans. And they gave Helios the job of finding out when they were going to leave. So he reported he had a source. One of his friends had a niece who was dating a German officer, and she told him when they were going to leave. So he passed the information on, and the day of, he saw the bombers go overhead and start hitting Salonika's train station. So he ran down there, sort of excited by this, you know, this was the result of his own intelligence. But when he got there, he saw the bloodshed, he saw the terror in people's eyes, because these were not smart bombs. They were also hitting local Greek houses and killing Greeks. And all of a sudden, you know, this war that was so pleasant for him became very real, and he saw the price of it. And he was overwhelmed with guilt. He saw the American airmen who had been captured, the bomber captains, and he wanted to run up and apologize to them. You know, he even felt guilty for these young Germans who were being killed right in front of his eyes. So yeah, that was sort of a hard-hitting moment in the book, because a lot of spies and secret agents, you know, they're far away from the war. They're passing along information, but they're not seeing the actual result of it. So this was when Dundalakis sort of came face to face with what war really is. And yeah, he was appalled.
In fact, you say in your book, he felt nauseated. He turned away and began walking home, quote, guilt pervading every fiber of my being. And to realize what he had done, he went up to his room and asked himself what he'd become, why he had, quote, departed from my true nature, a loving, compassionate individual who so enjoyed and valued life. He couldn't believe what had become of him. And when people would congratulate him, he'd say, don't you know, my message cost 3,000 people, soldiers, civilians, their lives. How can I be proud of that? And that's what I found so disturbing, too. How could take the life of a person they never even met? And I was touched by his reaction, it costing 3,000 people their lives and not being proud of it.
I think it just shows he was a good person. He was a moral person. And the way he eventually justified it to himself was saying, these Germans were going to France to kill Canadians and Americans, people just like me. So had I not done that, you know, the death toll might have been higher in France. I'm not sure he quite ever really accepted that because, you know, those people were far away and he was seeing dead bodies on the street. It's a very different experience. But yeah, I do think the reaction shows that he was not cold-blooded at all.
Well, there's another story that was hard to read. And Gennaris suffered a really severe wound. What happened to him?
They were attacking a German train that was transporting troops. And he was caught by a bomb and hit with shrapnel in the lower part of his body. And his fellow soldiers, he was the captain, his privates thought that he was dead. They left him there on the hill. And he woke up about 5, 10 minutes later, realized that he was pretty much surrounded by Germans. So he had to drag himself up the mountain, then down the mountain looking for safety, and was eventually found by two girl shepherdesses. And they helped him, got him to a doctor and things like that. But his injuries were so severe that they thought he was going to die on the way. So he had a really torturous journey out of Greece. They had to sort of transport him by donkey and carry him. It was extremely painful. And he thought he was going to either lose some limbs or he was going to die right there.
And this is the guy I talked about. Yeah, a guy who what?
I'm sorry, this is the guy I talked about who wanted to be buried next to the mass grave. So he definitely, you know, he definitely paid a huge price in the war.
Well, it's hard to believe when you're reading what happened to him, why he lost so much blood. How could he possibly survive what he went through? That was really hard to believe that he survived that, dragging himself because where he doesn't have plasma or medical supplies. That was rather amazing. So what were the consequences that he suffered after this really long delay of getting help for his wounds?
Well, he spent years in an American hospital dealing with the aftermath. Some of his limbs were paralyzed. He had to sort of work them back into, you know, being usable. But I think for him and many of the other people in the story, it was more psychological what they sort of took away from the war. Rodney Young became a very heavy drinker, would not talk about the war, sort of a true member of the Silent Generation. Dorothy Cox, declined very rapidly. She lost clumps of hair. She felt she was a failing person and that she had not done enough for Greece, and the guilt really weighed on her, so much so that Rodney Young almost sent her back to America for rehab. So I think they bore these psychological scars for the rest of their lives. It's just that Gennaris, the commando, also bore these deep physical scars.
And you mentioned shepherdesses, and that was heartwarming because in the middle of all these things that just tear at your heart, here are these shepherdess that fed him, asked him where they were going, and she invited Gennaris to eat with her. And that was, I enjoyed reading about that.
Yeah, I think she kind of fell in love with him. And when she learned that he'd been hit and been injured, she marched over mountaintops and carrying some food for him and cared for him until, you know, she could pass him off into the hands of some doctors. But yeah, I have to say the villagers really bonded with the Greek American commandos. They felt that these people were, you know, it's kind of their children. These were their sons who would come back to help free the homeland. So there was a very deep relationship between the ordinary villagers and these American soldiers.
And you mentioned that Rodney and Dorothy kept in 1957, they unearthed something that was not known about before. They made archaeological history by being the first to use an oil rig to drill down to this chamber. So they went back to their archaeological beginnings. So there are parts of your book that make us feel good about it, that they were successful in saving these artifacts for us, but so much of it is just how can human beings do this to other human beings? I just ask myself that on just about every page. So thank you for writing this book, Stefan.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been New York Times bestselling author Stefan Talti. His book is The American School of Spies: The Archaeologist Who Fought the Nazis and Saved the Treasures of Ancient Greece. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Warlock, for Bob Weir. Thanks for helping us dance with lightning. So rapidly our arms stretched, split, and flashed. Clouds we became, balls of gas whose shifted shapes each leapt and tumbled over its own bones. Then we were oaks who embraced the soil that thrived below our restless feet. Vagabonds with roots, that's what we were. We flowed in and out of dreams, then rolled in Earth's embrace. Thanks for the dance. Rambling gang of loners, we came to your feast, thrived as you pulled us into a hug. We sang together and were a choir of hope. Now time is clogged with aching tar. Our whole world wails. Somehow we must get up and dance with wild geese and storms. Paul Belts.
The Crossing. I can hear the footsteps sometimes far behind, yet closing. Or maybe I catch a glint of the watch glass from a distant ridge. My pursuer has the patience of one who knows the territory is bounded, the confidence of one who knows he has an ally on the inside. I can no longer quicken my pace. The things I carry, I hope to smuggle out, become lighter over time and more valuable. Memories of love and sorrow refined now into gems. My parents' last words, the people I hoped to offer healing yet wounded instead, our boys tussling like puppies, becoming men who are best friends. How I chose the road less traveled and kept you, my love. Death must take my body, but what of these belongings? Do they make the crossing? How can I know who I am without them? Or perhaps this bright handful has become seeds, hillsides of flowers, waiting for a new earth in which only dying creates the capacity for the dimensions to come. A butterfly alights on my shoulder, then skips away. It is a brilliant blue I've never seen before. I must have entered its home range. Hilary Lindauer Vasey.
Fear Built Home. My first home was built out of love, so I thought, but that love began to crumble and then to rot, leaving nothing but sadness and one tiny tear. So I built once again, but this time with fear. There's a white picket fence surrounding my heart, double locks on the gate that keep us apart. Shades are pulled tight to shut out all chance that maybe someday we'd share a romance. Tear-stained windows fogged over with lies. A dog at my front door barks away the sunrise. The chimney smoke billows with the stench of denials. It's thick and it's heavy and is seen for miles. Up in my attic amid cobwebs and feelings, paranoid passions are chained to the ceiling. Entombed in my cellar, having never been seen, where my hopes and my fantasies cuddle a dream. My first home was built out of love, so I thought, but the love began to crumble and then to rot, leaving nothing but sadness and one tiny tear, so I built once again, but this time with fear. Ronnie Burks.
Junction. We agree to meet at the next junction where junction exists. I will look at my trees and you yours. I will look at my feet and you yours. And I will try not to miss your walking company. But here I am, walking. And I will relish in that home for a moment. I will look at my trees, my bark, my bugs, smell my infinitesimal specks of dirt, my evergreen needles suspended, feel my shod feet fall and pick up along my path, dirt be moved. And I will relish in that home for a moment. But we will reconvene and build a makeshift hearth. Perched on our crackling flame, we will tell each other all we saw and felt, thought and believed. And we will relish in that home for a moment. We will roost until the fire dies, the fuel spent. And then we'll pack up in the morning and part to collect more. We will agree to meet at the next junction where junction exists. But here I am walking. Emma Miller.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.